Monday, May 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
They were never headed towards the kind of big, broad, comprehensive deal that he promised.
That's Phil Levy, senior analyst, commenting on U.S. President Donald Trump's tariff threat to China. Also ahead, there's mixed reaction from the Middle East over a U.S. aircraft carrier and bomber task force deployment. And U.S. Democrats move to hold Attorney General Barr in contempt. It's all on today's International Edition. An announcement by U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton that Washington is sending an aircraft carrier group and bomber task force to the Middle East is drawing mixed reaction from countries in the region. Iran has condemned the move, while some U.S. allies nod in agreement. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab media announced the U.S. deployment of the aircraft carrier group USS Abraham Lincoln and an air strike force amid reports of possible tensions with Iran and threats by Iranian officials to close the Strait of Hormuz to shipping from the Gulf. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, told a group of visiting students and teachers Sunday that Tehran would ultimately defeat its declared enemies, the United States and Israel, with the help of God. He says that despite all the propaganda and other measures that the U.S. is taking, and despite Iran's military disadvantage, he thinks that God will help Iran defeat the U.S. and bring Israel to its knees. Some Arab media reports said that Iran and its Lebanese proxy militia Hezbollah had supplied the Palestinian Hamas movement in Gaza with a new rocket launch system to hit targets inside Israel used during recent fighting. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Al Arabiya TV analyst Yusuf Azizi claims Iran has brought a number of its proxy militias from Lebanon, Iraq, and Afghanistan to its western Khuzestan province and might possibly try to attack U.S. forces in Iraq or Afghanistan. Iranian media says the militias are helping victims of recent flooding. Iranian analyst Masoud Al-Faq told Arab media that he believes Iran has no incentive to launch an attack against its adversaries since it is weaker than they are. He went on to say, however, that Iran does have a strong network of speedboats which could launch attacks against shipping in the Gulf. Iran's ISNA news agency also reported that President Hassan Rouhani would respond on Wednesday to U.S. sanctions and Washington's withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal by imposing countermeasures based on Articles 26 and 36 of the deal. U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of that deal on May 8th of last year. Rouhani told a gathering Sunday that the U.S. was trying to bring down the Iranian regime and Tehran must foil those efforts.
جنگ امروز ما با آمریکا جنگ در امید.
He says Tehran is engaged in a war with the U.S. to destroy Iran's political system and that Tehran must educate its young people well in order to prevent that from happening. Rouhani told another gathering that the U.S. was trying to starve it financially by preventing it from exporting oil, in addition to creating dissension among the Iranian people. He went on to suggest that Iran must increase its sales of petrochemical products to increase its revenues. Trump is expected to announce new sanctions on Tehran on May 8th, including on its petrochemical product exports, on the anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear accord. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Well, the chairman of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee is set to meet today with officials from the Department of Justice as the two sides work to resolve a dispute regarding access to an unredacted copy of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on his investigation into Russian election meddling. The committee moved yesterday to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress for refusing to turn over an unredacted copy of Mueller's report, with Nadler setting a vote on the contempt citation for tomorrow. Well, for more insight into this development and more, joining me live here in the studio is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, thank you so much for joining me.
You're so welcome.
So what is happening this week with Congress?
The question is what's not happening up on Capitol Hill in terms of the clash between Republicans and Democrats, between the House Democratic Majority leadership and President Trump. This is just the latest turn in what is really a battle over whether Congress has oversight over the presidency, and that has some very serious consequences for American democracy. What we will be seeing happen Wednesday morning is that vote in the House Judiciary Committee to hold the Attorney General in contempt for not handing over that report. Now, both sides are firing back and forth today, saying that neither side is negotiating in good faith, and that really depends on where you stand on each side of the aisle on Capitol Hill.
Also, looking at the Trump presidency now and into the near future, how is this going to affect his presidency?
Well, the president has been saying some interesting things lately about how this has slowed down his presidency, how it's kept him from implementing his agenda and doing what he wanted to do from the White House. We'll also see some increased calls for impeachment. We just heard Senator Elizabeth Warren, who, as many may know, is running for president herself in 2020, she just called on the Senate floor for impeachment of Donald Trump. I would expect that those calls will increase as these negotiations over congressional subpoenas go on.
Now, initially, Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, was not for this. So has she changed her mind?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is walking a very interesting line. She has to balance the desire to make Democrats look approachable to the general electorate, to voters in the 2020 presidential election. And a lot of them are turned off by all of this talk of impeachment, the partisan back and forth. So she can't push for that too much. But she also has to be aware of what history will say about her role. And she's noting that when President Richard Nixon was impeached, one of the articles of impeachment noted that he was ignoring congressional subpoenas.
So is this what this Donald Trump's, if this would happen, is this the same thing that they would use?
If he keeps pushing back against these congressional subpoenas, then that would certainly put the House Democratic majority in a very tough spot because there's that precedent set from previous presidential impeachments.
And so this would be based on the release of the report.
That's right. So the House Judiciary Committee sending these subpoenas to the Attorney General, to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice is not going through with them. That is ignoring a congressional subpoena right there.
So looking at the Democrats and the Republicans and with an upcoming 2020 election, what is in store for the American people?
What the American people can expect is that this talk of impeachment is not going to let up, particularly if we're still battling up on Capitol Hill over the release of the unredacted Mueller report. And why House Democrats say that's so important is that basically Robert Mueller said that he was going to step back from prosecuting the president for obstruction of justice. He left that question up to the U.S. Congress. But the U.S. Congress, the Democrats there, are arguing that they can't make that decision unless they see the full Mueller report and all of its underlying materials. That's why they want to get this so badly from the Department of Justice.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Lots of exciting news there. That's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson here in the studio. Among the top stories in the world, Malaysia says the U.S. government begins returning hundreds of billions of dollars looted from the 1MDB sovereign wealth fund. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo cancels a planned meeting Thursday with Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel in Berlin. And a group of eight Arctic countries, including the U.S. and Russia, reaffirmed today a commitment to maintain peace, stability, and constructive cooperation to those who live in the Arctic. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, China has confirmed that its top trade negotiator will travel to the U.S. to conduct a new round of trade talks later this week, even after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened higher tariffs on billions of dollars of Chinese goods after he complained the process is taking too long. Trump's Twitter comments on Sunday about the new tariffs sent Asian stocks tumbling on Monday and added uncertainty over the future of U.S.-China trade negotiations. Despite the market drop, China's official media largely stayed silent on Trump's comments yesterday. In his tweet, Trump said he would increase tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods from 10% to 25% on Friday. This would reverse a decision Washington took in February to keep it at 10% in the midst of trade talks. Well, VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Phil Levy, senior fellow on global economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, if President Trump is ready to follow through with the tariff threat.
President Trump has declared that his negotiations go well almost no matter what's happening. He'll declare that a very minor agreement is a fabulous agreement. The statement that things were going great plays well at elections. It plays well with markets when you want to give the impression that you're making great progress and you are a master negotiator. He's been setting himself up for trouble on this China deal because they were never headed towards the kind of big, broad, comprehensive deal that he promised. It wasn't going to happen. And that was setting him up for a choice between either having a much more minor deal where each side declared success or having a breakdown. It seems like the prompt for Sunday's tweets from the president was a statement by the Chinese that they were not going to actually write new laws on some of the issues that the U.S. had been concerned about.
The China markets have been having their problems, as has the Chinese economy. Where does a bluff like this leave the financial world?
It leaves it in a bit of a quandary, and it leaves it in a state where it has to do some very quick reassessments. The financial world had been notably optimistic about these talks. They believed the president's happy talk. The president had been promising that this problem was about to be fixed. I think what you're seeing is just the start of a reassessment, that there's still a question in people's mind whether this is a bluff and whether anything will be really different come Friday. But if they decide that it is, there's going to be some very rapid reassessments, both in financial markets and when you get to companies who are deciding where they're going to make purchases and where they're going to ship.
And what about the Chinese economy? Where does it leave that?
The Chinese economy has had more than its share of troubles, although it's worth noting that a troubled Chinese economy is one that grows at a little faster than 6%, whereas the U.S. economy grows at 3%. It's also worth noting that a lot of the troubles they've had stem from things beyond U.S. trade problems. So they've got issues with debt, for example. They would clearly like to reach a solution. And it is also clear that if we have a breakdown, this will be damaging to the Chinese economy. That said, it's not clear that President Trump has offered them a viable alternative to having a breakdown like that.
What do you think needs to be done? What kind of movement does either or both sides have to do to reach some kind of agreement?
It's going to be very hard to get something that's satisfactory by the end of this week. The Trump administration was way too scattered in its approach, way too far-reaching in its requests. There are important solutions that we could reach with the Chinese, but it's not something you do between Monday and Friday. The ideal that would happen is they would make what progress they can, accept that result, and then figure that there's more work to be done.
What does this whole threat for increased tariffs by the end of the week do to U.S. relationships with Euro markets, with other markets around the world?
I think it makes us look even more predictable than we've appeared to be under this president. it also has the potential to further undermine U.S. credibility. One of the real tools that a White House has to shape events and policy and other actors' roles in the world scene is you can make pronouncements and people believe you. This is literally the third time President Trump has announced a deadline for raising these tariffs from 10 to 25%. He didn't mean it on the first two. If he pulls back again, it's hard to see why anybody would believe him.
That was Phil Levy, Senior Fellow on Global Economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. While two Reuters journalists jailed for violating Myanmar's colonial-era Official Secrets Act were released today, while Lone and Jasa U were among thousands of prisoners pardoned by Myanmar's president as part of an annual amnesty issued around the traditional New Year. They were convicted and sentenced to 7 years in prison when they were arrested. They were covering the brutal military campaign in northwestern Rakhine State that drove nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims into Bangladesh in 2017. Last month, Myanmar's Supreme Court rejected an appeal of their convictions. Their lawyers said the conviction should be thrown out because the journalists were set up by police. And one law enforcement official testified he planted documents on the two men. VOA's Burmese service has closely followed the case. The chief of the service, Ton Lin Tone, says their release is important but doesn't address the underlying problem for journalists in Myanmar, which is also called Burma. He tells my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson, that journalists still are at risk because of the country's strict laws regarding the media.
Yeah, it is quite significant because of to be honest, that the whole world, all those international communities and the journalism communities are calling for their release. Because we all know that their arrest being a bit of unfair and they're being sentenced with the colonial era law, which is still existing in Burma. And there's a main reason for the Burma as a country in a kind of a media index. They are lowering down their status in the media index. So the release of the two writer journalists, Wallow and Torso, is quite significant, I must say that.
What does the release say about media freedom in general for the country?
We all have to welcome. We are welcoming that release. Of course, the family will be very happy. All those friends in journalism will be happy. But because of that circumstance, they are being released. The two of them are among 10,000 prisoners released by the presidential pardon to mark the Burmese Buddhist New Year. Of course, it is a kind of unconditional release, but that doesn't say that the current democratic government has actually reviewed or abolished that law or a kind of a penal code that criminalized press freedom and freedom of expression.
Are other journalists still in prison in Myanmar?
Yeah, there may be a few. But the main point is that there can be some more journalists who can be arrested anytime. Because, as I said before, there's a lot of law or penal code still intact in Burma. For example, like there are still the Official Secret Act, which was actually used to charge the two writer journalists. And also, there's some sort of law just to punish people by accusing disturbing the public tranquility, which is infamous 505B, or something like a lot of defamation lawsuit, or some sort of Electronic Communication Act called Section 6060. So there's a lot of unfair or kind of apparatus used by the authority to arrest and accuse of all the journalists. That kind of things are still exist. The main point is for this democratically elected government to review or, if need be, to abolish those unfair laws.
That was the chief of VOA's Burmese service, Ton Lin Tone, speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. While Lone and Jasa U were awarded the Pulitzer Prize, the highest U.S. prize for journalists for their work in uncovering the massacre, which they shared with two colleagues who completed the story after their conviction. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has made headlines for pushing through unprecedented reforms. But many challenges lie ahead in creating a national consensus. Discussing Ethiopia's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Need a little Straight Talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
A landmark 1,800-page report released yesterday by the UN says the world's biodiversity is in unprecedented and dangerous decline. The report, which was written by 150 scientific experts from 50 nations, urgently calls for transformative changes to protect and restore ecosystems on which life depends. Among other key strategies, it stresses the role that indigenous peoples must continue to play in the sustainable stewardship of the lands they have traditionally occupied. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Victoria Taul-Korpuz, the UN Special Rapporteur for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
The essence of the report is that biological diversity is in a serious crisis because increasing areas being converted into agricultural plantations as well as mining operations. There's also the continuing danger of indigenous peoples being displaced from their territories because conservationists want to keep out people. And they are also being accused as poaching the wildlife. So some of them are being killed. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, several Batwas have been killed.
I know that in your role as UN Special Rapporteur, you always stress the role of indigenous land rights and land tenure as key elements of the solution on many levels.
Indigenous people still continue to assert that they are the ones who have been conserving biodiversity in more effective ways, even that governments, like in the DRC, in Cameroon, the Batwas are the ones who are really conserving this biodiversity. This is part of their culture and their world. That's what different between them and the agro-industrialists, who just look at the land as productive unit, which should be deforested and converted into agricultural use. So if the rights of these indigenous peoples are recognized, then there can be a better chance to continue saving biodiversity as well as regenerating what has been lost.
So you're saying, in effect, that indigenous land rights are not just a matter of social justice or even human rights. They also address the biodiversity crisis outlined in the UN report.
Yes, absolutely, you are right. All this work that they have done in terms of protecting their forests, it's not just for their benefit, but for the benefit of the dominant population and for the planet.
What's an example of a sustainable indigenous practice that the rest of the world could learn from?
First of all, they don't cut forests indiscriminately because this is the source of their food, their plants, as well as their medicine.
Do you think it's possible to have some kind of a partnership where indigenous people can own and sustain these places, but the outside world can also have access to the richness and benefits that this biodiversity offers?
Well, I think so. There should be a partnership between the dominant world and the indigenous peoples for them both to benefit from what biodiversity has to offer. And I think one example of this is partnerships in promoting ecotourism, among other things. And there are also, of course, the medicinal value of plants, microbes that are found in those forests can be developed in partnership with others, but ensuring that the benefits are really accruing to the indigenous peoples in a more equitable way.
The tone of the report suggests that we may be running out of time.
We are running out of time. And if you link this with the climate change crisis, all sectors of society should really seriously think about what they can do to stop this global crisis.
That was Victoria Taul-Korpuz, the UN Special Rapporteur for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips from the Philippines. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.